This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll talk to the local author of a new book about wellness and business.
So much of the wellness industry is a story of seekers who were in some career that just really, maybe it was putting food on the table and earning them fairly decent income, but it wasn't really satisfying their soul.
Also, we'll check in with Garrett Olson from the Slo County Food Bank.
We don't have the space, the physical space in our warehouse to simultaneously process food to go out and also receive, inspect, categorize, and sort all of the food coming in. So we've gone completely virtual.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 23rd. I'm Carol Tangeman. Rick Stolmeyer hails from the Central Coast and co-founded the San Luis Obispo-based company MindBody. Earlier this year, Stolmeyer stepped away from his role as CEO of the tech company and transitioned to board chair. He's also written a book on entrepreneurship in which he offers business advice based on his experience over the years with MindBody. KCBX contributor Brian Reynolds spoke with Stolmeyer via Zoom about his latest venture.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by MindBody co-founder Rick Stolmeyer, who has written a new book, Building a Wellness Business That Lasts, How to Make a Great Living Doing What You Love. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your company is such a phenomenon here in the county and so well-known and well-regarded. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got to the point of writing this book and your trajectory in your business life in particular?
Well, Blake Beltram and I started MindBody in my San Luis Obispo garage in October of 2000. And I had a personal goal that after 20 years of leading the business and building it to this place, that a great time to hand off the baton to the next CEO would be in 2020. 20 years of doing it, I turned 55, and I called it my 2020 vision. And so the board and I decided to do this transition a year ago, and then I would transition into this executive chair role, which is a part-time role, and I still get to be involved in some of the most interesting conversations at MindBody, but it's not nearly as demanding as being CEO. So in concurrence with that transition, that turning of the page, I thought this is the time, if I'm ever going to do it, to write down everything that the MindBody team has learned about how to create successful wellness businesses. I'm also, of course, an entrepreneur, and I'm involved with the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Cal Poly, with multiple startups through the San Luis Obispo Hot House. I'm invested in multiple startups. So much of what's in this book actually pertains to any kind of entrepreneurial endeavor. I would say roughly 20% of the book is specific to the wellness industry, and about 80% of it is really about building any successful business. And I wanted to get that down on paper as part of this transition in my life.
People talk about bringing in big businesses or having them build a factory here or a sports stadium, but that's difficult and problematic. The very best way is to do what you have done with MindBody, and that is to grow and expand a business with worldwide impact, but local roots.
That's right. And we were able to successfully do it here in San Luis Obispo. And the simple answer is because we never found a reason why we shouldn't be able to do it here. And we found supportive leaders, in both the city and county government. We found support through the Chamber of Commerce, through the EOC, now through the organization called REACH. There is a solid, sustainable business ecosystem here on the Central Coast. And so I've always been motivated to continue to pay that forward. In other words, we didn't want to be the only successful tech company in San Luis Obispo. We wanted there to be scores of these kinds of businesses. And now that's what you see today. It's a very different environment than it was even 10 years ago. There are multiple exciting startups operating in this county. And I think San Luis Obispo County has put itself on the map as a hotbed of tech entrepreneurial activity.
Could you walk us through the idea of one of the things I found fascinating in your book, being a former, a psychology major at Berkeley back in the day, was Abraham Maslow and his hierarchy of needs, where clearly the most important needs at this bottom of this pyramid are safety, enough water and food, and so forth. But given the times we live in, COVID notwithstanding, it seems to me that the world is ready to go further up that pyramid to self-actualization and health, both physical and mental. How does that fit into your book?
Well, quite prominently, because one of the things I do in the book is go back and talk about the history of the modern wellness movement. I mean, some of the principles of wellness, like yoga and Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine, go back centuries. But this didn't become a popularized phenomenon until the late 70s, early 80s, when the baby boom generation entered their 30s, and for the first time were really concerned about their health. And what you saw was that's when you saw the Jane Fonda workout videos, you know, and you saw the emergence of some of the largest health club brands in that time, 24 Hour Fitness, Crunch Fitness, Equinox Fitness, Bally's Health Club, all emerged in that early 80s. And the reason it did is because the baby boom generation was the first post-World War II generation. And really since World War II, for the first time in human history, we now have billions of people lifted out of that subsistence you're talking about, you know, the food, clean water, and shelter, you know, being the physiological needs, and then safety, you know, safety from fear and threats. And now moving to the higher levels, the yearning we all have for love and belonging, for self-esteem, and then, of course, the ultimate that Abraham Maslow talked about is self-actualization. By the way, he published his paper on that in 1946. Wow. Right at the end of World War II. It's no accident, right? It really is. That was an epic shift in human history, and all of us alive today have benefited from that.
How big of a tent is wellness? In other words, it isn't just fitness, going to the gym, or having an exercise bike in your garage. Wellness covers a wide range of dimensions in human life and spirit, doesn't it?
Absolutely does. In fact, you know, wellness is a multidimensional concept. Most people say there are seven dimensions. Certainly, this is about what everybody wants to live a good life. Number one is to have a body that works, a body that's free from pain, that is able to do the things you want to do for as long as possible in your life. So that's the physical fitness. That's a physical cornerstone of wellness. And I think without that, it's very hard to have the rest, right? But in addition, that's not enough, because there's also emotional well-being, the ability just to cope with stress, which is so important in our modern world, more important than ever, isn't it? And of course, then there's intellectual well-being, the ability to continually learn and expand our minds. I think one of the fringe benefits of COVID is that all of us have become sort of armchair scientists now. We're now studying numbers and statistics and listening to scientists. I think that's a huge breakthrough for humanity. Next is a sense of social well-being, the connection to others. And these wellness businesses, we're talking about, yes, the gyms and health clubs, but also every form of fitness studio, yoga studio. We call them the kind of mind and body studios. These are also community centers. They bring people together. You go to these places to form friendships, meaningful friendships of people in your community. And it's a vital role that these businesses fill. Next is environmental, you know, that we all want to live in a place with clean air and clean water and free from toxicities. And that's environmental well-being is a key part of it. Next is occupational wellness, the work that truly fulfills us. So much of the wellness industry is a story of seekers who were in some career that just really, maybe it was putting food on the table and earning them fairly decent income, but it wasn't really satisfying their soul. It wasn't what their true life's purpose was. And they found it through becoming teachers and trainers and therapists and ultimately business owners and wellness. Lastly is spiritual. And whatever one's spiritual religious point of view is, understanding being connected to your spiritualism, to being connected to what you find to be your purpose and meaning in life is critical. And the wellness industry serves all of those dimensions.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Contributor Brian Reynolds is speaking with Rick Stolmeyer, co-founder of Mind Body, about his new book.
About a year ago, I read about this recently passed away Chilean economist, Manfred Max Neef, and he invented what is called barefoot economics. And the gist of it is that instead of measuring numbers and profits, we should measure how people's needs are being met across the spectrum, including, you know, the Maslowian stuff.
You know, I think the best way for people to understand it is, you know, think about the classic persona of a first generation immigrant to America. You know, whether your ancestors were Italian or Irish immigrants in the prior centuries, or whether your parents immigrated from Asia or Africa or Eastern Europe or someplace, or Latin America, someplace where life wasn't as good, and came here to form a new life. Well, their habits were formed in childhood, which is all about food, shelter, safety. So the classic first generation immigrant, how they behave, how they act. My grandmother was like this. She was born in Mexico and raised her children in the Great Depression. Her habits around, would she spend money to go to a health club, or would she spend money on a fitness class? Well, heck no, that wasn't in her mindset, but it certainly was in her children's mindset and much more in her grandchildren. So it's a good way to understand how people emerging out of really those lower two rungs of Maslow's hierarchy of needs will behave. They'll likely not change their behavior even after they have become affluent. But their children and grandchildren will want these other things, because once those basic needs are met, then you're thinking, well, okay, what actually leads to a healthy, happy life?
What was the fundamental building block of mind-body that then worked, you know, into this book and your accumulated wisdom? But what truth did you figure out and then share with your customers that made you such a smashing success? What's unique about mind-body?
Well, first and foremost, both Blake and I were and are children of small business owners. His mother, my grandfather, my father, three of my four brothers, all small business owners. We really got and understood the customer. The modern wellness movement has been predominantly driven by small business owners. Of the 55,000 studios and spas and salons that are in MindBody today, roughly 45,000 of those are actually small independent business owners. And they, this is a persona, this is a type of person that we no longer, not only understand, we truly love and care about. When he educated me in the late 90s about this emerging boutique wellness concepts like yoga, Pilates, and spinning were the big three in Southern California and San Francisco and New York in the late 90s. When I went out and met these people, I fell in love with them because, number one, I really saw the same personas as my family. I mean, these are scrappy entrepreneurs and they're utterly committed. They are borrowing money from friends and family. They're probably cashing in whatever retirement funds they had. They're taking enormous personal and financial risk to launch a business, all with the purpose of helping other people live healthier, happier lives. And so I found that deeply inspiring. They have rather complex business management needs. So unlike a health club that's just selling you a membership and frankly doesn't care too much how often you come. In fact, they don't want everybody to come all the time because they don't have enough Stairmasters and Ellipticals for everybody. Right. That's a very different and actually simpler model for a big box health club than it is for a boutique yoga or fitness studio, right? Because they're going to sell you incrementally on the services they provide, typically in some kind of multi-session pass, like a 10-class pass or a recurring membership that gives you some of this and some of that. And then they track your actual attendance, and they don't make money unless you stay engaged. So it is it's a much more direct engagement. It involves that teacher, that trainer, that therapist actually connecting with you personally and helping you improve your life. They're not just going to help you get firmer muscles or lose some weight. They're going to help you think about your nutrition, your stress management, and help you form social connections. So all of that we saw in the early 2000s is a big deal, and people are hungry for it. So we made the bet this industry is going to take off, and that's what it did. And then lastly, because they're so complicated to run, that we were the first to really say, you know what, let's put together the features in software to help those businesses run more easily. It's not just scheduling. It's about managing your staff. It's about managing all of your clientele and all of their accounts and all of their memberships. It's about being able to sell them products at the front desk. So it's a full retail point of sale system. It's about online booking. And then all the reporting and marketing tools behind that to help these businesses succeed. So basically what we realized at MindBody was, hey, this is a big suite of capabilities. And we were just crazy enough to go set out to try to build it.
I'd like to remind everyone, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by MindBody co-founder Rick Stallmeyer and discussing his new book, Building a Wellness Business That Lasts, How to Make a Great Living Doing What You Love. Getting back to your idea about the small business thing, I read somewhere once where the vast majority of innovations and inventions come from businesses with fewer than 50 employees. Mm-hmm. It's not mega businesses, but small businesses. So this isn't just about the health of people. This is about the health of communities.
That's right. There are hundreds of thousands of people employed in this industry, and they're employed predominantly by small business owning entrepreneurs who have an enormous amount of financial risk. And so one of the things that's been top of mind for us is to help these businesses adapt and get through the crisis of COVID, which has been devastating for many of their businesses. We feel strongly that the industry, what it does for people, makes it essential, and we should treat these businesses as essential services. Yes, people should take precautions. Yes, they should wear masks. Yes, we need to increase social distance. Yes, we need to do our activities outdoors whenever possible. And the businesses, if you walk into one of these businesses today, they're just immaculate. I mean, it's probably much cleaner than your home. They're doing everything they can to prevent transmission. And we hope that our government leaders recognize that these businesses are essential.
Is there anyone lobbying the top officials with this concept?
Not much. In fact, we're one of a group of leaders in the industry that have formed an association to lobby. And we just released a press release about that a few weeks ago. And it's something that in my role as executive chairman, it's actually number one on my list of duties to MindBody's board and to the company, is to be an advocate for the industry. We have outreach now to Joe Biden's team. We want to make sure that they understand the state of the industry, appreciate the role the industry plays, and that their policies reflect that.
Could we discuss just very briefly some misconceptions?
Well, I think, you know, there's probably a lot of people who don't understand the industry and think it's kind of woo-woo and out there and different. They might even feel like it's just politically not aligned with them, and none of that is really true at all. This industry is incredibly diverse. So every political background, every socioeconomic background, certainly every ethnicity, every religion is represented in this industry. What unites this industry is a recognition that by moving our bodies more, eating better foods in the right quantities, and managing our stress, that we will live much healthier and happier lives. And that by fostering positive social connections with others, well, now we really have the whole enchilada, right? That's called living a real life. You know, you could go to a CrossFit box. CrossFit is very popular with public safety, with law enforcement, with military. It's a lot of fun. It's a total kind of team experience. Women love it. You can go to the other end of the spectrum, and you could go to a Kundalini yoga class where they're going to be burning incense and chanting. Both of those are components of the wellness industry and everything in between. You know, I'm part of REACH, you know, the Regional Economic Action Coalition here in San Luis Obispo, which is a group of business leaders that they're all about promoting economic development in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County. And we were just beseeching the state leadership to say, look, stop just deciding what businesses are winners and losers here. Give your criteria. If you're going to operate, you must operate according to these rules. You know, people must have this many feet of separation. People must mask. Cleaning must be like this. But to have government telling us, well, that activity is essential, but that one's not, that's problematic, isn't it? And it opens us up for the kind of criticisms like, wait a minute, a liquor store is essential, but working out isn't. Getting my stress managed, you know, with a wellness experience, it's just not, of course, not true. And these services are, they're the last thing I'll say as a misconception about the industry, is that somehow this industry has to be juxtaposed against Western medicine. Absolutely not. No, all the data, all the experience indicates that if you want to maximize the positive outcomes of healthcare, well, you incorporate wellness practices. The two things work together in congruence. So you see hospitals where you can actually get acupuncture for pain relief. That works. You know, it's like 3,000 years old. It actually works. It's amazing. You see doctors who embrace a lot of the principles now that the wellness industry has been talking about for decades. So it's a yes and. It's not an or.
As we wind up the show, what would be the takeaway message?
Well, COVID has laid bare the real societal costs of modern living. For many people, this unfortunately has meant obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. these things ultimately are much deadlier in our lives than COVID itself. In fact, COVID has targeted people with those conditions. And so in our concern about our health in the midst of this pandemic, we need to attend to our wellness. So I encourage everyone, whatever that means, you know, there is now easier access via streaming video and video on demand libraries to classes you can do in your own house. There are many of these businesses are still open and operating. This is a great time to recommit to this. And of course, just go outside and walk and ride your bike and stay fit, folks, because we've got several more months of this to go. And we need to keep our bodies strong.
Co-founder of MindBody, Rick Stolmeyer, who's written a new book, Building a Wellness Business That Lasts, How to Make a Great Living Doing What You Love. Thank you so much, Rick.
Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live conversation with San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce CEO Jim D'Antona. Today, he speaks with Garrett Olson of the San Luis Obispo County Food Bank.
I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today you'll get to be a part of my conversation with the CEO of the Food Bank Coalition of San Luis Obispo County, Garrett Olson. After 30 years with the fire service, Garrett retired in 2018 as SLO City Fire Chief. Soon after, he joined forces with another former fire chief, Rob Lewin, and founded Resolute Associates, a consulting firm which provides services for community leaders, organizations, and businesses, specifically surrounding emergency management. When the pandemic began, Garrett and Rob donated their time to assist several local nonprofits, including the Food Bank Coalition of San Luis Obispo County. Garrett, thanks so much for being here.
Jim, thanks so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here.
What first sparked your interest in a career in public service?
Well, I actually started out thinking that I'd go into the military and actually went to the Air Force Academy for a few years before I pivoted. I felt like my desire to serve was more local. And so I'm the son of a former fire chief who was in Long Beach Fire Department's first paramedic class back in the early 70s. So back when the TV show Emergency was on, that was my dad, which was awesome. I'm also the brother of another firefighter. It's just a little bit that's in my blood.
How has it shaped your view of community? And what does it mean to take care of one another in this place we call home?
You know, I think anybody that has given of their time and themselves to community service knows the feeling that they have in their heart when they're of service to other people. And so it's a little bit selfish. I do what I do because it just makes me feel wonderful. I love helping people. I enjoyed my 30 years in the fire service helping people. I loved when I promoted and I was off the fire truck. Nothing made my day like hearing stories from my firefighters about their interaction and their service to our community. And the same here. You know, I spend a lot of my time on spreadsheets and Zoom calls. But yesterday afternoon, I ended my day literally with the rest of the staff with an all hands on deck food distribution preparation where we were literally preparing food to go out to California Valley. That was the highlight of my day. So literally getting my hands on our mission here or for the 30 years I was in this fire service, getting my hands on the mission just brings me so much joy.
I talked a little bit in the start about your transition from fire to consulting and now to the food bank. How did that come to be?
You know, it's a great beer drinking story, Jim. Retired out of the fire service, joined forces with an amazing SLO resident, Rob Lewin, who was also a fire service leader, started this consulting firm, and we were doing everything, not just emergency management. We were helping the Downtown Association with their strategic planning. When the coronavirus happened, we were doing some land use stuff. We were, and Rob continues to be very involved in San Luis Coastal's emergency planning. And so when the coronavirus happened, a lot of agencies that had no emergency management experience hired us. And then we also knew there were a lot of nonprofits that didn't have the resources to hire anybody. And so we leaned in on a couple of nonprofits that needed help, but probably didn't have the financial resources to do it. So we became the pro bono emergency management consulting duo. And the food bank was at an awkward time to be in a CEO search. The position had been vacant for about 3 months. When we started to lean in and provide emergency management skills, they asked if one of us would join them on a full-time temporary basis just to bridge the next 4 to 6 weeks until they onboard the new CEO. And again, it's a much longer beer drinking story, but ultimately the board asked me in May to come on board as a CEO. And it's just been, I never thought after doing the fire service for 30 years that I would find another career opportunity that touched my heart as much as this one did. And I was absolutely wrong.
In that interim role there, you talked about making emergency management plans. Is that part of the problem, is that we don't think about emergency management and we just react when it shows up?
Yeah, I think there is so much on our front burner, small businesses and organizations. There's just so much on your front burner that you can't even imagine what's on the back burner. You just don't have the capacity to spend enough time thinking what if. And then when that what if happens, it really is a different skill set to be able to see through the chaos and simply be calm, listen, focus on solutions rather than blame. You know, if there's accountability that needs to happen because of some organizational mistake, that happens when you have the luxury of focusing on accountability rather than the fix. You need to encourage healthy dissent and make informed decisions, be nimble, and always have a backup plan. And while many businesses have that acumen for their primary function, when an emergency happens, oftentimes that same acumen isn't as fully exercised as it could be. And Rob and I, as Resolute Associates, spent 30 years just doing that. That's what, you know, you show up and there's the house on fire and people waving at you out a window, and you don't have the ability to buy into the drama or emotion that's going on. You just have to size up and make really rapid decisions based on the best information that you can.
Looking at your new role, what's been that most rewarding part? You talk about all of the rewards of all the things.
There is an absolutely brilliant team here. And it has just been the joy of my professional career to come, and we are quite literally on our fifth organizational chart here at the food bank. We have moved people around, created new assignments, promoted from within, and used the internal talent to its highest and best capability. It's my goal, and it's always been my goal when I was in the fire service or here, it's always my goal to prepare people to move up to the next level of leadership position. So my greatest joy has been working with this incredibly amazing team. And I guess I have to add the second thing that has just been emotionally overwhelming to me, which has been the response of our community. You know, a lot of people don't understand the finances of food banks. 72% of our operating fund comes from people like Jim D'Antona. It comes from people who donate to the food bank. And we exist because of the grace and generosity of this community. And this community has leaned in to support us during historic times. Hunger has more than doubled in Slo County. We're giving out food at historic levels. We would get people that would literally sign over their stimulus check to us because they realized there were other people that were in higher need than they were. So these are people that qualified for government help and had just this beautiful heart and turned that money over to us. And so whether you're giving us your $1,200 stimulus check or you're giving us $5 because that's what's comfortable to you, our community has come out and it's just been an absolutely beautiful story. I don't know to what degree that story is repeating in other communities, but it's happening here in San Luis Obispo and it is just amazing. Also, we're a small team of 28 people trying to feed 74,000 people who are hungry in Slo County right now. It used to be 44, 45 before the pandemic. It's now greater than 70,000. We could not do what we do without the over 2,000 people that volunteer with us each and every year. Some of them every week, some of them once or twice a year. But we exist because of this community to serve this community. And it has been eye-opening and heartwarming for me.
That's a number that would overwhelm and sink most organizations. Is it something that just shows up in November and December, or 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, our neighbors are having that issue?
24 hours a day, 365 days a year, our neighbors are having that issue. So how did we get through 2020? There are a couple of beautiful stories to be told there. I already mentioned our amazing donors. I will share with you that when we were front of page on the New York Times, not us, but food insecurity and food banks, or the lead story on CNN because of that historic long line at the San Antonio, Texas food bank, miles long of people needing food, our community gave to us. And it got us ahead of the game, procuring food to stay above that explosive need. However, 3 months later, when the headlines moved to the election and other developments on the coronavirus, our donations dropped off to pre-pandemic levels. So we're feeding 154% more people, and we've dropped below where we were before the pandemic in terms of giving.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Garrett Olson of the San Luis Obispo County Food Bank.
What got us through 2020? Our donors, and also an incredible story that not many other communities can report, it was our relationship with the county, with the County Board of Supervisors and Wade Horton early on. And that was what brought Rob and I to the food bank, was helping write a contract between the county and the SLO food bank. Early on, our Board of Supervisors and County CAO wisely looked to the food bank to make sure that we didn't have food shortages in our county, which not only would affect people in need, but could also lead to food riots. And they were really concerned about that. They gave us $650,000 worth of spending authority to pre-purchase food to position our county so that we were well positioned for the long haul. That made the difference for us. So we normally, this time of year, we rely on food donations. So this is the time of year when barrels are out at fire stations. I used to be on the other side of that barrel as the fire chief. And we can't do that for a number of reasons, public health reasons, but also logistics. We are packaging food to be distributed to our community at historic levels in our warehouse, and we're needing to maintain spacing of 6 feet for all of our volunteers and staff. We don't have the space, the physical space in our warehouse, to simultaneously process food to go out and also receive, inspect, categorize, and sort all of the food coming in. So we've gone completely virtual. We normally, during this time of year for the turkey drive, our trucks would be in the parking lots of grocery stores accepting frozen turkeys. We can't do that. If our drivers get sick, 74,000 people will be without a food resource until they're done quarantining. This is the time of year when Season of Hope and KSBY would have barrels at fire stations. We can't do that because we can't possibly process all of that incoming food. So we are quite literally losing about $697,000 worth of food value in 2020. And so I'll remind you, the amount that the county gave us to purchase food, $650,000. The county filled that need for us. We would be dead in the water if not for their pre-planning, their generosity, and then their disaster service workers. When the library shut down and librarians still needed a place to go, they were here packaging food and helping us. So that is a story that didn't get told far and wide enough. And if you know a county board, a supervisor, or Wade Horton, send them an email right now. They made some brilliant decisions early on, and we are grateful for that.
Well, you used a number that it just seemed shocking. You said, again, as we were talking about the amount of people in our county that are food insecure and that are going hungry, that number was like 70 something thousand. That's a quarter of our entire county.
Jim, I'd be really surprised if everybody wasn't either knowingly or unknowingly one degree of separation away from somebody that is new to hunger. When the coronavirus happened and the economic fallout happened, so our warehouse, our location is not normally a distribution site. This is where we move food out into the community. But anybody who shows up here hungry is going to leave with food and with information where they could get it closer to where they're living. We saw a 485% increase of people showing up here hungry. And those are people who were new to food insecurity, and they quite literally Googled SLO Food Bank, found our address, and came here. The face of hunger, I was talking with somebody the other day, and they said, oh, it seems like the face of hunger has changed. More accurately, the face of hunger has become familiar. It's become intimate. It is your favorite restaurant staff person, and that restaurant is now shuttered. It's your favorite shopkeeper. It's all of these folks, gig workers and artists, 74,000 people, if you don't know one of them, I would be absolutely shocked. And the scary thing that we're learning about how this is really structurally changing a lot of our assumptions about the economy on the other side of this downturn is that economists that were hired at the national level to take a look at food insecurity across the nation. And these are folks that don't work for a food bank. They were hired to give them an independent assessment. They were asked to forecast how long this arc of hunger is going to stay at this level before it returns to what was already a tragic number. I mean, if coronavirus didn't happen and I was telling you 45,000 people in SLO County were food insecure, you'd say that's a terrible number. And you're right. It is a terrible number, especially for such a rich and wealthy country in a beautiful area. But what we're learning is that because of the systemic changes in our economy, that they are anticipating it could take up to 10 years before that 74,000 comes back down to about 44,000 in our community. And that's why we're really encouraging our donors to join us for the long haul. I love talking people out of giving us big checks. The reason why I love talking people out of giving us big checks is because I'd love to talk them into becoming a sustaining donor with us. Sustaining donors are the foundation on which this food bank can plan our operations into the future. And if right now you said, hey, I want to write a check for $10,000 to the food bank, I'd say, that's awesome. How about you write one check a month for $1,000? At the end of the year, you're going to give us $2,000 more than you had planned. But I can plan our food procurement, our staffing, our fleet replacement, all of those things based on our sustaining donors. And that's really what we've been focusing on. Every dollar you donate to the food bank, we turn into 7 nutritious meals. That is not a marketing ploy. We are audited on that number. So if you said, hey, I can afford to give $10 a month, I'm going to sign up for $10 a month. Every month, you will have the peace of mind and good karma that goes with knowing you're feeding 70 hungry people a month. Tragically, about 35 to 40% of the clients that we serve are children under the age of 18. So I couldn't imagine. I was just meeting with some Girl Scouts out back that just gave a donation. It was lovely, from Arroyo Grande. And I was talking to them about the school year and just the look on their masked faces of sadness over just how it's going. They miss their friends. They miss all of the routine. I couldn't imagine being 14 years old and going through all of the upheaval that is 2020. I can't even fathom doing that hungry. And tragically, thousands of children are food insecure when they wake up each and every morning. This used to be called our summer breakfast bag. This bag is what we've been giving out all summer and since then, and we will be giving out for the rest of this school year. It contains 21 nutritious meals that can be prepared by a child. And so we give these out all over the community through our 81 agency partners, other nonprofits that source food from us, and at our 60 distribution sites every month. I don't know how you could put your hands on something like that and know that a hungry child is going to have 21 breakfasts and not have it just melt your heart and open your wallet.
Imagine trying to learn while hungry, but try to deal with 2020, which none of us are doing very well
at. Yeah. And Jim, we serve the community directly at those 60 sites, but we have 81 nonprofits and religious organizations that are our partners that help us. Our footprint is the entire community, from Napomo to San Miguel and from California Valley to the coast. We serve the entire county. Echo Shelter and 40 Prado and Loaves and Fishes at Grace Church and Boys and Girls Clubs and Salvation Army and Cuesta College and Cal Poly. Tragically, 11% of four-year college students will realize food insecurity during their college experience. And so we couldn't do what we do without those 81 partners, Atascadero Loaves and Fishes, Paso Loaves and Fishes. I mean, I could go on and on. You could go to our website and go to the food locator and see all of those amazing organizations. So when you give to the food bank, you are also providing us the ability to give food to the community. We are going to be providing 1,520 turkeys through our distribution sites and agency partners this year for free. We're not asking our agency partners to chip in at all. And that historically, we've asked them to help a little bit. This year, we received some amazing grants and love from our community, and we're passing that love on to our agency partners so they can give it to their clients in need. If there's an organization on the front lines of hunger, chances are they have a connection back to us. We'll get to the other side of this, and we'll have an opportunity to point fingers or learn or whatever we think is healthy to do. Right now, we just need to put on our tough game face and stick with it and march through this, holding on to our values and our core mission. When you can hold on to your values and your core mission, you're going to get through anything.
But has there anything that's been a silver lining or that you hope becomes permanent from this pandemic?
A couple of things. As much as you and I love being on Zoom meetings all day, we have learned that it serves a really valuable purpose. So we serve the whole county, and we like our board to reflect that geographic footprint. And it's difficult for people that live in the far north county or the far south county to be board members of an organization that it might take 45 minutes to drive to for, you know, a 1 hour meeting. And so on the other side of this, I think our board will likely embrace Zoom for maybe every other meeting will be online. And I think that's a good thing. I think we've gotten smart with regard to that. You know, the other good thing that's come out of this is many of the processes here at the food bank were sufficient during times when we were running at half speed. We thought it was full speed before because that was all we knew, but now we're running twice as fast. So ergo, in retrospect, that was half speed. Well, it's caused a lot of things to crack or even to break. And we're prioritizing what do we put duct tape on versus what do we replace right now? And I'm talking about systems more than equipment. And so I'm thankful for learning about Zoom. I wish we could have learned it under better circumstances. And I'm also thankful that we took the RPMs on this car up so much that the things that were shaking and cracking, we've identified, and we've got great staff that is well-suited to prioritize what needs to be fixed now or capture what we know we need to fix down the road, and we'll fix it. You could go to slowfoodbank.org and go to our food locator and find all of the 81 agency partners that operate congregate feeding and pantry operations, find the location of our next distribution site, or somebody could literally show up here and walk in the door, and they do every single day. Right before I jumped on this meeting, I was helping somebody in our pantry give them food. We didn't get a chance to talk about our nutrition standards much, but the food that they got was good for their body and their mind. But they could show up here. And when they leave with nutritious food, they also leave with a flyer in English and in Spanish that shares with them where they can find food in the future.
Garrett, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for the amazing work that you and your team and all those people involved with the food bank are doing.
Thank you so much for what the Chamber's doing to advocate for businesses. You're doing strong work, and I look forward to you getting them back on their feet, because that's going to mean we can slow down a bit.
That was Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo's Chamber of Commerce, speaking with Garrett Olson of the SLO County Food Bank. Each year, several organizations across the Central Coast organize public lunches or dinners celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday, meals that feed thousands of people. This year, of course, things are being done differently. The annual Grassroots 2 Thanksgiving dinner, which last year served about 2,500 community members, is being served to go on Wednesday from the Slow Elks Lodge. Call 805-544-2333 for more information. Stay tuned tomorrow for a KCBX News story on what's happening with various local and public Thanksgiving events this week. On today's episode of Playing with Food, Father Ian Dellinger takes us to Lulu Farms in Atascadero to explore edible flowers.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm Playing with Food. Have you ever been to a fancy reception with wine flowing and an array of canapés made with all manner of produce from the Central Coast, charcuterie platters in various corners of the room, alongside cheese boards large enough to climb? And when you were at these schwanky events, in the days when they used to happen with frequency, did you ever notice the flowers that adorned these platters and boards? These colorful additions to our party going have replaced the kale that was used for decades as the garnish or to add some color to an otherwise boring stainless steel tray. Did you know, though, that a lot of the time, those flowers are edible? There are loads of edible flowers all around us. Like the kale garnish, which is now in everyone's smoothies, the decoration on your cheese board is indeed edible and delicious. And on a windy summer afternoon, I went up to Atascadero to find out more about edible flowers. It was indeed pretty windy, but the tasty treats were well worth it.
Hi, I'm Zena Engel, and my husband and I own Lulu Farms in Paso Robles. We have about 2.5 acres. It's just my husband, myself, and our 3-year-old that farm it. We also have a 1-year-old. She just can't quite help yet. We have a lot of different herbs. It's kind of part of our herb program. We also expanded into edible flowers. You're not allergic to bees, are you? Forgot to mention. Okay, well, there's a beehive right here. Okay. We have a Waray hive that you can see there, and then we have a Langstrom in the back. The girls are out doing their job today. That's another reason why we expanded our edible flower project, because of the bees, and they really love it. Obviously, bees love flowers. The trick is keeping up on picking the flowers before the bees pollinate them and they turn to seed. A flower is a plant's like biological necessity to reproduce. So the flower is produced, it gets pollinated by a pollinator, whether that's a bee or a hummingbird or butterfly, etc. And then once that gets pollinated, it either turns into fruit, which actually has the seed inside of it for a lot of things, or it turns into a seed, just straight up. So flowers will change from a flower into seeds. Plums, obviously, they turn into plums, which have the seed inside. And the reason why they're covered in tasty fruit is to get animals to take them, eat them, and then scatter their seeds, basically. The flower is what attracts the pollinators. Because we keep bees, we are a zero spray farm. Even when you're certified organic, there's still about 50 chemicals you can spray. When you have bees, there's really only 3 that are genuinely safe for bees. You can see our honeybees, and then you can see all these little teeny, teeny, tiny bees. Those are minor bees. Honeybees are sort of the only bee that people really think about, but the smaller bees actually do a much more efficient job of pollinating. So this is our original edible flower spiral. We're in the process of redoing it and replanting. When COVID hit, edible flowers were sort of one of the first things that people stopped buying because it was very much like a luxury item. As I was saying, when you have bees, it's hard to keep up on picking before the bees can pollinate it. Once a flower is pollinated and the plant goes to seed, it sort of completed its biological necessity. So the plants will either kind of die off or go dormant. So we're in the process of redoing the original circle and replanting. When COVID first hit, this whole thing was an amazing bright yellow, bright orange, bright white fluff of flowers that were probably about 3 feet tall.
Wow.
And then we actually added on a secondary flower spiral specifically for photos because we had a lot of people who toured the farm and wanted to take pictures and we wanted to have like a pretty backdrop. So that's where I figured we could taste some flowers.
Okay. So once a bee pollinates a flower, how long does it take to go to seed and go dormant?
It sort of depends on the flower really and the size. I can show you these are calendulas right here. So this would be freshly opened flower, and then this would have been open for a few days. This has already been pollinated by a bee but hasn't quite turned to seed versus this one down here. You can see all the little seeds have formed.
Right.
And then this will actually dry out and repropagate itself.
So you can still pick it and eat it right after it's pollinated, but you've got to really watch it?
You could eat it. I mean, you could depetal it because this type of flower, the base is a little bit tough and chewy. So typically you would depetal this flower to eat it. So you could still eat it. It's just not kind of as fresh as a freshly bloomed flower.
Right. It's like the bougie supermarket versus the dollar store.
Yeah, you could look at it that way. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe like a glass of wine, like if you like had a bottle of wine and you drank everything but a glass and the next day you were like, well, I still just kind of want a glass, so I'm going to drink it. And you're like, ah, it's all right, but it was much better last night. So this was our secondary spiral, but now it's our primary spiral while this one's recovering and being replanted. If you just want to follow the path, take us into the center.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian, tasting flowers with Zena Engel. And of course, the wind kicks up during the most interesting part.
So, we have zinnias, moose. Sorry, moose is obviously not a flower. He's my obnoxious dog. We have several varieties of marigold, borage or borage. We have calendulas. We have one of my favorite, actually, you see those big fluffy white ones right there? Those are actually carrot blossoms.
Oh.
And they taste like carrots. It's an amazing, like, you eat a flower that actually tastes like a carrot.
And is it a carrot underneath there?
It is, but ironically, once the carrot blooms, it puts all of its energy into upward growth to produce the seed. So if you look at that one over there, you can see how it's already gone to seed. The actual carrot itself kind of shrivels up and becomes smaller because it's no longer putting the energy into producing the root. So initially when you plant the seed, it puts its energy into producing the root and getting bigger and stronger and more established. And then it puts all of its energy into growing the flowers.
To propagate itself.
To propagate itself, exactly.
How do you know if a flower is edible? Do you know because you've done the research?
And
that's
yes.
The kind of flowers you've planted? Or...
Yes.
Okay, so if you're out in a forest, is it okay to try, or should you just be like...
I would not recommend that, because all plants create a beautiful flower. Some of those plants are poisonous. Just because they're poisonous doesn't mean that they don't want to propagate themselves. Not to say that eating a tiny little piece of a flower is going to kill you, but it could make you sick. It could make your tongue go numb. You could have an allergic reaction. I wouldn't recommend eating random things if you don't know what you're doing.
And another fairly obvious top tip is to wash it before you put it in your mouth. Not only do you not know who's been there before you, you don't know what happened on or near that flower before you got there. Zena makes the very good point that just because something is edible doesn't mean it tastes good.
So zinnias and snapdragons are two edible flowers, but they have a very bitter component to them, so not everybody particularly likes them. So nasturtiums are edible. They taste like radish. They're an amazing edible flower. So roses are edible.
Yeah.
Obviously, roses are highly perfumey. Not everybody likes that amount of flavor.
My sister was really into rosehip tea, and I've been to Turkey where a lot of their candy is flavored with rose water. And
then also the flowers from the herbs are edible. So like basil flowers, fennel blossoms. When it's an herb-based flower, it's going to taste like whatever herb that is.
So can I taste some?
Of course.
How do I start?
You know what, let me try and maybe pick sort of milder. I would maybe pull some petals off of this cosmos. A lot of flowers aren't going to have a super intense flavor. Some do have a very intense flavor. I always tell people who are sort of intimidated by them to just look at it as really pretty lettuce. Here's one of the carrot blossoms.
Oh yeah, I definitely want to try the carrot. It tastes like a woody carrot.
An old carrot.
An old carrot.
Zena worked with a chef with her carrots and her carrot blossoms. Zena gave the chef a bunch of rainbow carrots, and he made dishes based on the color of the carrots, including a purple carrot gazpacho garnished with none other than the carrot blossoms. Sounds delish.
So what's this?
The water, it's a pluot marigold water.
The marigold flowers are in there, and then
yeah,
the
I muddled the marigolds on the ice and then added the pluots as well. My husband used to be a bartender. When we first started the farm, would take different components into work and kind of mess around with them.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Playing with Food on Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian with Zena Engel of Lulu Farms in Atascadero, tasting wildflowers. So what's the outlet for her flowers?
Farmers market?
We don't do farmers market. When my job transitioned over to Peacock Cheese, I already had all of the chef contacts. We started off as 100% chef direct, which doesn't work when most of your restaurant customers are closed or only have 5 tables in them, or as the case may be, outside of them. We have sort of shifted a little bit this year. We started a micro CSA program for friends. CSA means community supported agriculture. It's a veggie box, basically. We have a little farm stand that will open up periodically when we have an overabundance. Some of our restaurants are still around catering.
What are these furry things?
That is the borage right there.
Oh, wait,
so
okay.
That is this little guy right here.
Yeah.
It kind of tastes like a fishy cucumber.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
But not offensive.
The barrage is one of her most popular flowers among her chef clients. However, the petals are very small and time-consuming to work with.
In terms of your season, are you able to produce all year round?
Our flowers typically go year round.
And how do you do your packaging then?
We triple wash them. Like I said, we're zero spray, so you don't have to worry about any kind of chemical residue or anything, but it is a farm, so it is dusty and dirty. And then we just have them in clamshells, just like you saw Destiny. That's like a large clamshell that she got from us. We do them all the way down to little, small, $5. And they're all sample packs. It's just going to be a huge variety of things.
And then once you clamshell them all, is there a proper way to store these?
In the refrigerator.
Okay. And how long do they last once they're picked?
It depends on the flower. I mean, you can see these have kind of been sitting out for a little while. Some flowers are more delicate than others. That's why we usually include some of the more stable flowers like marigolds and zinnias, because they will last for a couple weeks, versus like the barrage is one of chef's favorites, but also one of the first ones to kind of wilt and go.
And what do you use the edible flowers for? Obviously this beverage is very refreshing.
Cocktails, definitely a top one. Garnish, of course, for cheese plates or on salads. You make a salad and you kind of pull the petals and sprinkle them, and then it goes from just like a blah salad to, I mean, you could go get a generic salad from a restaurant and sprinkle it with edible flowers and all of a sudden it's gourmet.
Will that work with my bag salad?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It makes a beautiful garnish. One of our customers who got our edible flowers off of Harvestly actually froze some in ice cube, which I haven't done yet. I've put them in cocktails and in beverages, but I've never thought to actually freeze them in the ice cube, which I thought was a really clever idea, because then it stays preserved in there for longer and you also don't get petals in your mouth while you're drinking.
So it's more than just sprinkling on a salad or using it to make a cheese plate look nice. There's lots of things that you can do with them.
There's lots of things. Edible flower pancakes are gorgeous. So you sort of cook the pancake right before you're going to flip it, put pansies and things into the top. When you flip it over, be very careful not to burn it, because then the flowers will kind of not look pretty anymore either. But you flip it over, and then when you flip it over, it looks like pressed flowers in your pancakes. That's one of my favorite things to do with them. My daughter, she's only one, but she's obsessed with flowers, so she really loves those. There's all sorts of medicinal applications as well. Echinacea, we don't have any echinacea blooming right now, but the echinacea flowers are really pretty. You can make teas and things out of those.
So there is a lot that you can do.
There is a lot that you can do. And there's a lot of marigolds. You can see we have a lot of those. The other benefit of marigolds is that they're a very good pest deterrent for the farm. They help keep a lot of pests away. They help deter ants, cucumber beetles. There's probably a list of 20 plus bugs that they help keep out of the garden.
During one of the windier parts of our conversation, I asked what makes a flower edible. It's edible simply because it's not poisonous. But as you heard Zena say, some taste better than others. I knew about edible flowers, but my first exploration with them was a couple of years ago when I was exploring the kitchen garden at Westmont College with Kenny Chisholm. You'll find that episode on the Playing with Food podcast page. Since then, I've noticed edible flowers at all of these posh events, and I sought out Zena to find out more, and she had a similar response to mine.
I guess my biggest thing is that people should not be afraid to try them. You know, a lot of people are intimidated by edible flowers, or they think of it as just garnish. You know, when I was growing up, nobody really ate kale. It was that fuzzy green thing that you moved off to the side of your plate. Now everybody eats kale. So my biggest thing with edible flowers is encouraging people to actually try them and not just throw them away or push them off to the side, because you might be missing out on a beautiful citrus or radishy kind of pop in your mouth.
During the shelter at home period, I am definitely missing out on the posh food and drink events. But thanks to Zena and specialty farmers like her, we don't have to miss out on the added joy that edible flowers could bring to our dinner tables. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX. www.lulufoundation.org.